Hello. I'm the gong that will start the song at the beginning of every lecture for 2 weeks. I think Dan told you something that I will put on a spin on something. Something like that. I'll put a spin on some story. Okay. I think he meant this. So, just look at my hand, and I'm trying to rotate my arm by 2 pi. And it become like this. It's about 2 pi. And then you can continue to do it for another 2 pi. Oh, it comes back. So today we're gonna start study such an object. Okay, so I guess according to Dan's idea of that putting a spin on something, we're gonna study the quantum field theorem part 2 called a spin not equal zero. Okay, I think the motivation is very clear, so I'll give you a very brief motivation. If you just look around us, and if you want, you can look into the universe, but everything is made with electrons, nucleons, photons, and a minute dose of other things. Okay, dark matter is a big dose, but we don't know much about it, and possibly it's described by quantum field theory, so it's still interesting to study quantum field theory. But at least, but anyway, our part will focus on the electrons and the photon. And so there is really only one scalar particle that we have discovered, which is the Higgs. But for generations of physicists study the scalar fields. Why? They are the one needed the motivation. That's why Dan gave you much, much longer motivation. Because they really need a reason to. Well, sometimes, you know, as a physicist, you study because you can. It's something simple. Okay, relatively simple. As you guys are working on dance homework, you might disagree with me on that. But there's only one component of a scalar, and they transform trivially under Lorentz transformation, as all the 20-ish people that I have read about the homework one, which is good. And on the other hand, we're going to study the constituents of the world, the reality, ourselves, and about these important real particles. And very often, we'll look back to the past 2 weeks, and hopefully we'll learn some lessons from it, and that hopefully will make things a little bit easier. Okay, so I guess we should have an outline of the course. The outline looks very similar to the title. So we'll spend about 3 lectures. I can't estimate how it goes until, you know, it goes. About 3 lectures to study, let's say, at a spin 1/2. It's quantized, and that's the next level. It's a natural thing to study. And it was study equation of motion, why not? And then, of course, after we have an equation, we should solve it. So we should study the solutions of it. And actually, we have some, you know, simpler version of solutions, as we will see tomorrow. Various kinds of solutions. And then we'll try to write down the Lagrangian of it, because we have spent 2 weeks to learn if you have a Lagrangian, you have an interaction term, how do you study physical things such as cross sections? So we need a Lagrangian. Only having an equation of motion is not enough. And actually, we'll go a little bit further. We'll see what kind of a Lagrangian with this spin 1/2 things are allowed. We'll make the complete list. So if we ever want some interactions, we just couple it with other fields, something like that. Okay, so next, of course, we're gonna quantize this thing. Of this spin equals 1/2 thing. And then, the next, we'll go up another one, says, well, but we're already familiar spin equals 1, which is the Maxwell theory. And if you somehow it's a little distant, don't worry, you'll get a homework, get a review on it. So, but then we'll skip the whole part of studying all this things without a quantizing, we'll just directly go into quantizing. Actually, you've already seen the quantization of spin equals 1, 2, that you have seen the Coulomb gauge, but we are the relativist people. So we really want to quantize in a way that is covariant. There is a perk. The perk is we can maximally profit from what we learned in last 2 weeks. Then of course, there's always caveats and the price you have to pay. And we'll see about that. And then in the last lecture, of course, everything should interact with the other. So we're going to make these things, spin equals 1/2, for example, electron, to interact with spin equals 1, for example, photon. Then they will interact. And then this is the famous quantum electrodynamics. It's like the electrodynamics, but it's quantized. And often they just brief this thing as QED because you write it often enough. Okay. So before we start, it's just a couple of things. It's like a convention thing that it's the same convention with Dan. I tried my best that we follow the same notation and stuff. But it's good to get this straight because people use different conventions. Well, the physical results should be all the same. Okay, so we're still in the most minus convention. Such, it has a perk. Then you can just write to the energy relationship like this. And then we are still in H bar equals C equals 1. I think we're in the G equals 0 convention because we have no gravity whatsoever. We also use Einstein convention. Pairs of indices means a sum, unless otherwise stated. Okay, if there's other things come up, we'll mention them. Okay, so let's get started. So I'm going to tell you that for the first three lectures, we're going to study spinners that describe spin 1/2 fermions. And at this point, you should really stop me. You were like, what are spinners? How do we know they are spin 1/2? How do we know they are fermions? I just like to speak one sentence with three things that should be questioned. I'll tell you the answer to the first question. The spinner is the solution of a Dirac equation. And now you'll be like, what's Dirac equation? So I didn't really answer anything yet. I gave a definition. And we'll spend roughly half the lecture to define this thing. Well, actually, a little bit. My estimate is 2/3 of the class to define what is a spinner. But first, let's find the equation. Okay, we'll take a historical route. In history, apparently when Dirac was trying to find his equation, he was staring into a fire. And suddenly that's very inspiring and something hit his head and it's like the bubble with the light. He got his equation. But let's go a little further back. We'll go back to 1925. So Schrödinger has this awesome idea, says that I should replace the energy with the operator I partial t, the momentum with minus I gradient. Yeah, this should be familiar to you. And then he write down, says, I don't care about the relativity. It wasn't discovered that long. And without relativity, the world would function just fine for a few hundred years. So he says, let me do this, and I get an operator equation. I'm going to act it on some wave function. And I get that. Schrödinger equation. And the Schrödinger equation has a probabilistic interpretation, says if I have the density Schrödinger psi star psi, then it's positive definite, so I can use this to describe what's the probability of finding a particle somewhere. Yeah? Story is clear? And then, of course, we just want to include a special relativity. The only thing we want to change is from that guy, we change to partial mu, partial nu, which is just defined by pp squared equals m squared. And then we make the replacement that p downstairs mu is I partial x mu, which is just going to be abbreviated as this. And then if you make the substitution, you get something like I partial upstairs, I partial downstairs. Let's make it acting on something, acting on the same thing. And then that gives you a minus one, you move on the other side. You get a Klein-Gordon equation. Huh? Okay. I hope I'm not going fast because this is something you haven't already known. And thanks to everybody who has submitted the homework, that we can, I'll just directly write down the Klein-Gordon density, which is, I'll take the zero component because I'm looking for a density. So as you all argued in your homework that we want to just take a phi star phi, but that's not going to work because we have to respect the special relativity. If we want to have a conservation law, the density that respect to special relativity had better to be a time component of a current, which is a zero component of this four vector, which you have already seen from the first 2 weeks that look like this. Okay, so this is just the only candidate. I want the density, that's the density. There's no argument about it. And now, the thing we want to do is that, well, let's take, so after you have been through the first 2 weeks, you know that whenever you have something you want to solve, it's always the Fourier expansion. So it's always going to be a plane wave of some sort. So let's just take a look at a solution that is proportional to a plane wave, see what happens. So what do you think happens if I take such a plane wave and plug in the energy density? I mean, the density that I wanted to call it a probability density. So you have the derivative respect to t, which is just giving you ik0. Then the other part just cancels. It's e to the ikx and e to the minus ikx. And the other term will give you the same thing. So this thing gave you minus 2k0. Oh, here's a problem. If I have a solution with k0 bigger than 0, I have some density, which I want to call it a probability density, which is negative. OK, as you have learned in the last 2 weeks, it's not necessarily a problem. You can interpret it a different way. You just have to abandon the fact that this is a wave function. Well, Dirac doesn't know that. He's staring into the fire, and he's deeply troubled by this thing called a negative probability density. He says, no, I'm going to write an equation that has not this problem. So what do you think, which part of the density change make the difference, make this negativeness shows up? It's a question. In case you didn't notice my tone, since I can't speak question mark. Oh, I can say question mark. So if you look at the two density, which part do you think this make that density has a chance to be negative? Question mark. Minus actually this part will just give exactly the same thing as this part. So for the purpose, you can ignore the second half. What do you think? If you look at this and this, what's the difference?
I.
There's I, and then what else there is? There's a time derivative. No, we can't take time derivative. If you have a thing, and now you decide to take some derivative, then of course it become not positive definite. Okay. Well, if you trace back, what do you think it's the difference between in the original equation? Still a question. If you look at the Schrödinger equation, the Klein-Gordon equation, what's the difference?
Time derivative.
There are two time derivatives. So what Dirac wants? Dirac wants is one time derivative. Okay, very good. He also wants special relativity because the non-special relativity thing is already done. Schrödinger nailed it. Okay, so if I want one time derivative, what do you think the next line I should be writing down? What does special relativity do? It says time is not a fixed quantity. Space is not a fixed quantity. Some of you even said in your answers says they are mixed up. So if I want something that respects special relativity and better treat time and space equally, which means what's his second requirement of his equation? It says he wants one time derivative.
One
space derivative. Exactly. Then he says, well, I have a third requirement. He was like, Klein-Gordon start with that special relativity energy momentum relationship. I want that too, to respect special relativity. I mean, his goal never changed. He wants to write down something has a special relative in quantum mechanics together. So he says, I also want this. But in other words, he also wants this. But this definitely does not fit the bill. This is a Klein-Gordon operator. Okay, this is Dirac choice. Oh, historically, it's chosen to be Poisson. See, we are very important. You are very important. Anyway, so, but this is not one time derivative and one space derivative. If only I could just take a square root of this, all problem solved. We'll have one time derivative and one space derivative, and I'll just square it back to get my energy-momentum relationship. And that's a brilliant idea, isn't it? Except that thing is not easy to take square root unless we understand it as a complex equation. See, if I have, okay, this might be, okay, I'll write it in a way that you definitely recognize. This can consider to be taking the complex square root of a square plus b square. I mean, we're not going to get a real square root out of this. So we'll just go a little further, which is not that bad considering the partial derivative is always associated with I to be interpreted as the momentum anyway. So it's not that a crazy idea to think of this term as this term that we can associate Samayas with. Yeah? So after combining all these thoughts, Dirac says, I want some I, some partial derivative. This one really doesn't matter, because if I add a minus sign, it still works. So I want this. This is my square root. But there is a problem, isn't it? I do need some linear coefficient. Yeah? Historically, it's called gamma. Don't ask me why. It's just history. Then Dirac write this down and claim this is the Dirac equation. Well, let's just quickly check that indeed it is a square root of Klein-Gordon operator. So what do we want to check is this thing multiplied by its complex conjugate. Let me change a letter. Yeah? Okay, and then the last term is good. It's just plus m squared. And you can see the cross term, it's exactly the same except off by a minus sign, which is good because I want them to cancel. And the first term gave you something like gamma mu, partial nu, partial mu. Now if we compare with the Klein-Gordon operator, we just want this guy to be equals to partial square. In order to make some comparison, I'll write it this way. Yeah. I'm not going too fast. Dirac, according to his first two requirements, wrote down something with a linear in time and space derivative thing, operator thing. And then he says, let's check that my solution is still a solution of Klein-Gordon equation. And from that, he gets this thing. So the next step to do is realize this thing is symmetric. I'm sure that almost all of you get to be tortured about the symmetry of things in the relativity interview. So I'm pretty sure you know what to do now. Is that this is symmetric, and I better replace this guy by its symmetric part, because that's the only part that's going to survive. I'll symmetrize this thing, and now I can equate. So we realize, okay, not all linear combination is going to work, which is of course true. And we will also define a curly bracket notation for this thing called the anti-commutator, which is just change a minus sign to plus sign. So this is the anti-commutator. If you multiply and switch and add together, it's just going to show up a lot more often in the future. So we'll have a notation. Then I could use the new notation, says that this gamma things, the linear coefficient should be satisfy this thing, which is called a Dirac algebra. So Dirac followed his vision, write down a first derivative in everything equation, demand his solution still obeys Klein-Gordon equation, and I realize there's some things needs to be some constraints on his linear coefficients. Okay. Yeah. Any questions up to now? Yeah.
So I have one question.
Yeah.
Which is when you are taking the square root of a derivative.
Yeah.
You are also violating the locality principle, right? Because derivative, square root of a derivative, if you expand it as a Taylor series, you will have infinite number of derivatives, which you don't have a local action.
Well, it's more, this is just a way of saying it. It's really squaring this should give you that. So when you square things, you don't violate the locality.
Okay.
Hey, let's just say, okay, it's, that's just a way to remember how Dirac equation is derived, but what is the correct way to say is that this operator squares to Klein-Gardner operator. Yep.
Don't you generally want to dagger the gamma if you're taking a complex conjugate of the equation? So you'd have gamma.
Ah. Good question. And it will...
I guess we're like, we explicitly put the I on the d mu to have it be Hermitian. I guess we want gamma to be real.
No, gamma is not real.
Right.
Gamma is not real. Okay. Yeah, this is a very good question. Well, I guess the idea is that, okay, so maybe we shouldn't say, okay, you're very right. Maybe we just shouldn't say it's a really square root in quotation mark, that we really shouldn't say it's the square of the operator, because as long as we can find any operator acting on this, then you can say Psi is a solution for Klein-Gardner equation. Like whatever acting on this guy doesn't matter. Also, maybe in the history way, you would say that let's envision gamma to be real, and I try to do this. And then when you come back, then you realize, okay, gamma is actually not real crap. But then you realize it doesn't matter. What matters is you have a Dirac equation that is annihilated by some operator that combines to give the Klein-Gardner operator. Okay, thank you. So it's really not much a square root. Okay, let's put it in variants of quotation mark. To be very quotation mark. Okay, yeah, you're right. But that doesn't invalidate our argument. As long as you find some operator, and this operator we found just happened to be look like the complex conjugate, but it's not. Okay, so now I have a question. So if we stare at this thing, how many degrees of freedom on the right? I feel I'd ask this at least 15 times in the interview week. But I'll ask again, how many degree freedom does this have on the right-hand side? In four dimensions, let's stick with four dimensions. We have a metric. How many components? Good, just yell at me, 10. So let's say, suppose these are ordinary numbers. How many variables are we looking for? If gamma is just ordinary linear coefficient as we hoped, how many degrees of freedom we have? It has 4. Okay, we have 10 equations and looking for 4 things, it's not gonna work. Even if they're complex, we're looking for like 8 things. So we know that these are definitely not numbers. And as you guys are so familiar with linear algebra, you would know that we'll end up calling gamma matrices. But let's leave it for now, because now I must have made a confession that I have lied. This is not how Dirac wrote down his equation. So what Dirac did is that he really wants to write down something analogous to Schrödinger equation. So what he writes is this. Oh, maybe that's why he chose Psi. It even looks similar. And what he writes is this, and he calls this the Hamiltonian operator, and makes sense. So let's say what Dirac's equation look like. This will give us some insights, further insights on this gamma. Okay, so what Dirac says is very funny, isn't it, Dirac? You want a special relativity equation, but now you decide to like actually explained it right, explicitly write everything out. Very interesting, but let's follow you. So I'm just writing the time and the space derivative component as Dirac told me to. Oh, missing a term. Missing a term. All right? And the next thing I do is I move everything else to the right. Okay. So now what I do? So this is our equation. Okay. Since Dirac equation is so important, I shall write it again. So this is our starting point. I want to, and we want it to look like that. Yep.
Is it what? Sorry, why isn't it minus I gamma I di?
Oh, I'm just moving this to the right, and moving this term to the right too.
But aren't you using the plus minus minus minus?
Yeah, but I didn't.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. For convenience, I never try to specify, like it's still just, if it's summing upstairs and downstairs, I don't have to worry about the metric. I'll use this trick later, so I don't have to worry about the minus. So what do we do now? If you compare this with this, we're off by a gamma zero. How do I get rid of it?
Multiply by gamma zero.
Yes. Multiply by gamma zero, because look at this cute thing. Or wherever we got it, it says gamma zero square equals one. So I can just multiply by gamma zero, which gives me whatever it multiply gamma zero gives me. Okay, and this is what he calls the Hamiltonian operator. Which makes sense. It'll come back later. That indeed you will say that our Hamiltonian indeed look like this. But that will be after we introduce Lagrange. But now, as I said, do this little calculation, we want to get some insights on gamma zero. If it's a Hamiltonian operator, it means, what can you tell me about a Hamiltonian operator? Question mark. Yeah? What is, huh?
It's
Hermitian because it's the observable. Excellent. So we know this thing. Well, both terms should be separately Hermitian. Let's look at the simple term. This term just have gamma zero. So we immediately get is gamma zero is Hermitian. And then if we look at this term, I'm going to use a trick that you should all know, is that whenever I say I times partial derivative, I say it as momentum. Since it's observable, it's Hermitian, so I didn't see it. The only thing I see in that term that it has questionable things is this term. Yeah? So from the second term, immediately give us gamma zero is Hermitian. From the first term, I saw a momentum operator, immediately throw it away because it's Hermitian. And the only thing left is this guy. Well, let's just calculate this guy. This guy is that times gamma zero. And then we can use our cute gamma zero trick. Says that the gamma dagger must equals this. And we can even use more of our gamma zero trick. Says 1 gamma 0, 2 gamma, 3 gamma 0. Well, okay, every pair doesn't count. So I can write it like that. Now they look covariant. Well, I can't really say that because they're a bunch of numbers. They're just labeled this way. But I find out how to take Hermitian conjugate of gamma matrix. As you might have imagined, in the later on, we're probably taking a lot of inner product of things. take your information, knowing how to dagger the gamma matrix is a good skill. So much we learned about the gamma matrix is that they satisfy the Dirac algebra. And then if you want your Hamiltonian to be Hermitian, the gamma matrix satisfy that Hermitian identity. Okay, so, well, Dirac write down his equation, then he's facing another puzzle. Again, you know, with all the wisdom about solving things, he also wants to look at a plane wave. Plane wave is back. Okay, there's something in the middle there, which is quite a thing. So we'll just leave it like that. And I think by the end of the second lecture, we'll have a sneak peek of what stands in front of the plane wave, and which is causing a lot of trouble compared to the scalar case. Because the scalar, you just write a linear coefficient. But we just figure out they can't be just linear coefficient. Okay, but we'll worry about it later. But we claim that they can still be expandable in this wave. And he decided to take his energy of this plane wave, and he get I times ik zero, minus sign. Uh-oh, that's not good. Well, in some sense, in one sense, our world is not stable, that we can just go down and deep down to the energy is not bounded below, and we can just drop our energy down, there's no ground state, and just keep going. But if we ignore that problem, this is pretty good. It tells you if you just produce this psi particle and you gain energy, actually. This is like the ultimate perpetual machines. But no, this is not good because it will destroy our world first. And then, you know, Dirac is a genius. He says, my equation has a problem, but I'm going to propose this ingenious solution. I say the universe. I say that I'm writing down an equation for electrons. No idea why. We'll spend lots of lectures to show this psi thing is qualified to describe electron, namely that it's spin 1/2, it's a fermion, it has charge. He doesn't know that. He's just like, this is the equation I'm writing now. And it's also like, it's not like I have a telepathy power to tell you that's what he wants, because his title of the paper is Quantum Theory of Electrons. So that's clear what's in his mind. He was like, hey, electrons has Pauli exclusion principle. Let me just assume that all the negative energy of the entire universe is filled up. There is only positive energy available to us, problem solved. And then he has an even more genius idea. He just realized, okay, but these electrons that's filling his Dirac sea of negative electrons, the negative energy, the electrons. If one of them get some energy, which is possible, absorb a photon, something like that, then he jump out of sea, it will leave a hole behind. And Dirac realized this hole will behave anyway just like electron, in always, except it would have a negative charge, which he says, electron must have an antiparticle, which we call it a positron. And then this is like the most successful theoretical prediction ever. 2 years later, positron was discovered in the chambers. It's pretty amazing. We'll definitely come back to talk about antiparticles in the future of our lectures. So, but from now on, our history review is done. That we'll move on to study, from now on, we'll always refer this thing as a Dirac field. I just want to tell the story, write on the equation, find some gamma matrix identity, and then now we'll only refer them as a Dirac field. Okay, I guess Dan says he has a tradition of a break. But do you guys feel you need a break, or we can just keep going? Okay, how about that? Today is the first day, it's a Monday. Monday you have a bonus. First I'll tell you a story. And then you can have a break. Now we can come back to resume to do a, okay, slightly longer, maybe 4-line derivation. Okay, so this story is actually Tiberius. It's a good story. It says that Schrödinger, Heisenberg, and Bohr, they go fishing. And then at the night, they get some fish and they camped. And then there's a thunderstorm. And the Schrödinger wakes up first. And he wants to divide the fish in equally 3 parts. But he realizes it's not possible unless he throw away a fish. That's what he do. He throw a fish back to the waters and divide the rest of the fish in 3 parts. And then he took 1 part as his own and he left. And now an hour later, Heisenberg wake up, has no idea that Schrödinger has already gone. And then he will be like, okay, I'll just divide the fish in 3 parts. Guess what? He finds that he has an extra fish. Guess what? Great minds think alike. He threw that fish away, divided the rest of the fish in 3 parts, take his 4 part, and he went back. And you know, Bohr wakes up. So we're all physicists. If we are mathematicians, no, we're physicists, so we don't consider exceptions. It works for n equals 1, n equals 2. So you know what Bohr did. He did exactly the same thing. And the next day, they realize they all have equal amount of fish. Now here's the question. Where are they fishing? Question mark. Okay, we'll take a 5-minute sharp break and we'll resume. So, yeah, I'm gonna start. Has anybody think about where are they fishing?
I see. Direct fishing.
So if you work out the problem, it seems that the only way it's gonna work is they each have a -1 fish. So apparently there's only one place ever that they can achieve that. Okay. So welcome back. We have a Dirac equation. Oh, let me write down this. Why do I just like to write down Dirac equation again and again? No idea. All right. So actually, we should think about this a little harder. So we tried our best to respect special relativity by treating the time and the space in equal base, make sure the energy momentum relation is obeyed. And we really have another really important thing we really should check, which is, what else do we have to require this equation?
The density is positive.
The
problem that you started with, the density is positive?
That's a good question. The density is actually positive at Dirac's level because it's Poisson, Daguerre-Poisson, just as the other case. We'll come back to that problem later. That's very good. Dirac achieved his goal. The density is positive. There's some negative energy issue, but he solved that by proposing antiparticles. They are discovered. happy ending. But if we really want to say this equation is compatible with Lorentz symmetry, what else we need to check? Yeah? Okay, you're going further. You are about 3 lecture further. So suppose Poisson change in some way. So for example, Al Merrily says hey, per se doesn't change under Lorentz transformation. Is there a problem? Under a Lorentz transformation, if per se does not change, do we have a problem with this equation? What's the problem? People are nodding. What's the problem? You look at each, okay, maybe sometimes notation is not helping. So do we have any problem now? If we stare at this equation and then say, I do a Lorentz transformation and I propose per se does not change. Is there a problem? Does the mass term change? No. Does the connected term change? Yes, okay. That's not a good, right? What I'm trying to say is we want to require the covariance of the Dirac equation. Okay, we tried hard to respect the special relativity, but we never really check. Does it really respect special relativity? Okay, in other words, okay, maybe you will see the relation later. In other words, before we dig into all this, oh, I have matrices, we should work out what are these matrices, and work out how to multiply them together, do some commutator, there's lots of things you can do with those gamma matrices. But before we dig into that, like a really tedious business, we should ask ourselves some philosophical question. Like, what is this per se? Well, you might tell me that a per se is a program to bring very intelligent young people into this Waterloo place and get them trapped here to do a boot camp. But my question really is, what is per se? For example, one thing you can tell me what is per se is, how does it transform under the Lorentz group? Well, as we just argued, it better transform. Because at this point, the mass term transform, the connect term doesn't. So we established psi prime at x prime cannot equals to psi. And I'm going to postulate it's some linear combination of psi. Okay. So because we already established that the gamma matrix, gamma are matrices, so they must acting on some column thing, have some components. So this is just a matrix multiplication with index suppressed. But here's a question. Why do I think a per se prime is actually a linear combination of psi? What makes me be able to do that? Why it's definitely a linear combination? Well,
is it because the derivative?
Yeah, exactly. The Lorentz transformation is linear. The equation is linear. So that psi will also transform linearly, and everything could be linear is good. Linear means we can use linear algebra. Okay, so we realize, so what exactly do I mean by covariance of the Dirac equation? It means in one frame, I have a Dirac equation. In another frame, I'd better also have a Dirac equation, right? So let's write out, spell out, what do we mean by that? Is that in one frame, I have this. In the second frame, I should still have a Dirac equation. That's what we call this Dirac equation, is covariant. Changing frame, well, if it would be a disaster if equation, you know, holding one frame doesn't hold in the other. Okay, so we're just going to do that and try to figure out how, what does this transformation that depends on the Lorentz transformation look like. So I should write here, says x cosine mu is equals to lambda mu nu x nu. Okay, so this is old frame, new frame. And I can write the inverse of that relationship, because if it's a good transformation from between frames, you better be able to invert it, because the inverting a frame is very easy. Okay, now we're just going to plug it in. What I get is I gamma mu, and now we'll use the chain rule. And then I'll just plug in what's the inverse relationship. And now I can compare. Oh, it's even on the same level. So there's an inverse relationship, plug in, and use chain rule on the derivative, and we have S lambda. So I wrote that just because that will immediately make the mass term look exactly the same. And now I just need to make the term in the middle look the same.
Are we so sure that gamma matrices are not frame dependent?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, we are postulating as some them as some linear coefficients of a equation. So
the equation would still be linear if those gammas depended on x.
Sure.
Lorentz transformation does not depend on.
Right, so gamma matrices are a bunch of matrices with numbers that do not transform under Lorentz and doesn't have dependence on X.
I know that from
yeah.
usual, but I'm
yeah.
asking you using this approach, where do we see that?
When you square that, you took the derivative, you took gamma out of the derivative to get the Klein-Gordon equation, right?
Yeah, okay.
So you implicitly assume that it's
great point. So we already assumed that they are numbers. Okay, great, thank you. Okay, is everyone following? I'm just doing very silly things such as bring down the new index. But everybody is following here. Is that we realize this transformation needs to satisfy this equation to make Dirac equation covariant. And how do I solve this? How do we solve anything? What's our favorite method of solving anything? If we can't solve it for any situation, there's a joke I missed. Okay, if we can't solve something for a large region, what do we do? What do we always do?
Taylor.
Exactly, Taylor. So we're just gonna tailor this whole thing. So this is the long calculation I promised before the break, and now everybody is refreshed by coffee, tea, or any other methods. Okay, we're gonna do this. So let's do the first, this thing is simpler. Okay, I'll just ask you guys that if I expand my Lorentz transformation with some infinitesimal parameters, how many do you think there are? Well, let me be correct and write the first part. Yeah? If I expand my Lorentz transformation at an infinitesimal distance from identity, how many parameters there are? Six. Yeah, I read all your assignment. You guys all most of you guys tell me six. So there are six of them. Okay.
Why is this eta not the identity? Why is this eta not the identity?
It's the identity?
Yep.
Sorry.
It is the identity because your lambda should have one upper, one lower index.
And then I lower it, it'll become eta. Sorry. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you very much. Yeah, it was identity before. All right, yeah, sorry. So there should be this identity part, and I decide to lower one for interesting reasons. So what do you think of the symmetry property of this? There are six of them. Clue is there are six of them, because you know there are six generators, so there must be six parameters. Yeah?
It's symmetric and it doesn't have any trace.
Is it symmetric?
It can be symmetric.
If it's symmetric, it has 10. Yeah. So this thing must be anti-symmetric. Okay. Yeah. I'm just using like silly arithmetic identity, very important arithmetic identity to say this thing must be anti-symmetric. Of course, this is a little fishy, but you can show that. So this is what we mean by expanding a Lorentz transformation infinitesimally. And you can write down the x psi upper mu part, and using the following cute rule that Lorentz transformation is a transformation that preserves the length. So if you write down the upper one, okay, let's just do it. It takes one line. Okay, this is the upper one. And then now I want to dot product together. The first term vanish. The second term is eta mu nu, x mu plus x mu, rho, x mu. And I can switch this. You realize this two term is exactly the same, which means this term is zero. Since it's symmetric here, it better be anti-symmetric there. Okay? So we realize there are six parameters. They are anti-symmetric two index things. Of course, you ask me, why don't we just label them epsilon 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? That's more symmetric this way. And there might be other merits. Okay, excellent. We have six parameters, and you guys also have done the homework on how to relate a group element such like this guy into exponential of its generator. And who, I have no idea what other generators are. But I can always write it this way. Yeah? True? And we all know how to expand this guy. All right. Now we're going to do the long calculation of the day, which is plug in that expansion into that equation and say where we are. Ready? Okay, it's not that bad. It's only three term. And we're doing linear expansion. Okay, let me change some labels. Theta is the important part. Yeah? As usual, the first term will just give you the right-hand side. The beauty of, yeah?
Are we missing an I in the exponent?
Very good question. That's when you learned about the unitary transform representation. And the problem is we're doing a Lorentz group.
Oh.
And it is non-compact. So it doesn't exist a unitary representation. Well, doesn't exist a finite dimensional. Actually, this is a very good question because we're going to see at the end of the lecture that it's indeed not a unitary.
I know that it's not, but people usually still put I and then just comment that some generators are not Hermitian because of that.
Yeah. But it's different connection. You move I here, then when you solve S mu nu, then you have I there, right? You're just moving I around. And I decide to do it this way, just S mu nu look a little. S mu nu look a little prettier. Not too much prettier. Yep. That is pure convention. I actually have to check through all the conventions because I was following many textbooks. Okay, so it's not that bad. You take all the one term, you get the right-hand side, and the first term give you, well, this, because the rest are all one. And there is this term. That term just give you gamma nu, epsilon nu mu. And the last term is 1/2 gamma nu epsilon. So that's it, right? Linear expansion, you only take one linear expansion, the rest you just take one. Okay, so the thing I'm going to do is, in order to get rid of it, this thing, I'm going to replace this by that. Yeah? It's just this equals this. Okay. Now, we're almost done. I can also replace this mu by beta. Yeah? Last thing, sorry, is that this is anti-symmetric. So at a better anti-symmetric this part. So this is the middle term. Okay, now I can throw away all the 1/2s. I get 1/2, so now they all have a term like that. We can throw the infinitesimal parameter away. And what I left, those are the two terms, and I can move that guy to the right. And this is the commutator. And the other side, there's nothing I can do about it. I'll just write it down. Okay, so 1, 2, okay. On the second, the third, okay, about 4 lines, maybe 5, okay. The idea is we can use this infinitesimal method to change the equation imposed on all the group element of this representation on the generators. So we realize that in order for the Dirac equation to be covariant, they had a better transform in a way with the generator satisfy equation like this for the gamma matrices. Okay, so here we go. We're gonna stop doing long calculation and just guess. What's the symmetry property of S alpha beta? The anti-symmetric. And apparently they have something to do with gamma matrices. So if you just want to guess what the answer should be. Question?
Commutator.
Excellent. I'm just going to guess the answer is the commutator. And then you'll spend another about 3 lines of calculation to figure out this is a quarter. Not a quarter. Is actually important. So now we can finally answer the question, what is a spinner? Well, a spinner is a solution of the Dirac equation. It transforms, and under Lorentz transformation, it transforms with this S lambda thing. And the generator of S lambda is a quarter of the commutator of gamma matrices. So now you know, if I ask you in the interview, what is a spinner? That's the complete answer. I might ask a follow-up question. Okay. So but like you were like, what the hell do you mean? Like, how can I make any sense of this? What do you mean that the psi transforming in this way? It seems something crazily complicated, and how do I have gained any intuition on them? Well, we don't have spinners, like, you know, well, I guess we do, but we'll try to gain some intuition on it and try to understand what is S doing on our psi. Okay. So to do that, we have to make an analogy with something we do understand, which is the ordinary Lorentz transformation. That we understand to the bones. Except we never try to understand it in the current way, this fancy generator thing. But come on, Lorentz transformation acting on a vector. Presumably, I can do the same thing. I can write it as e to the 1/2 epsilon mu nu. Wrong letter. Alpha, m alpha, and mu nu. So these are just generators for the vector representation. Okay. I can clearly do that. And then, what are this M thing? Well, for this, I'll write them all downstairs because alpha beta, what's the symmetric property of alpha beta? It's contracted with epsilon alpha beta. So it better be anti-symmetric. And if I just take one component of epsilon, say 1, 2, then this M12 thing is an infinitesimal expansion of the Lorentz transformation, so it better be anti-symmetric too by the same argument there. So this is a subject that is anti-symmetric under alpha beta, anti-symmetric under mu nu. And this time we don't have gamma matrices, we're talking about vectors. We don't even know about a gamma matrix. The only thing we have is metric. You probably have seen this trick in relativity. We're just going to guess and write down something containing 2 metrics, so 4 indices that has the symmetric property that we just said. And there's only one such thing. And again, you can figure out the proportional constant. This step happened to be 1 to satisfy the true Lorentz algebra. But this thing do. And I'm not going to try to show this thing satisfy the Lorentz algebra. So just completely due to symmetry, this thing is fixed. And it's this. OK. So now come to the question I asked about the xy plane rotation. So what we know is that this is how a vector transform under the xy plane rotation, since there nothing happens in the other two directions, I'll just write a 2x2 matrix. Since we're going to compare this infinitesimally, so let's do that. Okay, now I just need to compare with this guy. Which means I need to read the index. Okay. This guy, the index is raised. So this index is raised. This index is raised. Okay. I want, so the same argument, the epsilon 21, M21 is the same as epsilon 12, M12. So that 1/2 is there to cancel that effect. So what I only need to calculate is epsilon 12, M12. So M12 obviously doesn't have any components in the 0 and the 3 component. So if this is 1, this is 2, clearly the component not vanishing is 1 mu x 1, nu equals 2, all the other way around. So this will give me a minus 1, and the other one will give me a 1. OK, so I conclude that epsilon 12 is theta. So what happens at theta equals 2 pi? By this new formulation, I get e to the 1/2, well, 1/2 is canceled, so e to the this matrix minus 2 pi, no, there's no 1, just 0, okay? So guess what is this result? What's the exponential of this matrix? You can use Mathematica. Oh, didn't ask you to bring it mathematically. You can also actually exponential this matrix by do the Taylor expansion and calculate. Okay, we also have no time to do that. But it's a rotation around 2 pi. So guess the result is. Yeah? The identity. Okay, if you calculate this matrix multiplication, it will give you identity. Just put it in mathematics. It will give you. I also tried the Taylor expansion thing. It works. It tells us the Taylor expansion of sine theta works with radius of convergence infinity. So this thing works. Okay. Okay, this is very good. XY plane rotation using the same formalism. That means it's a vector, if you rotate 2 pi, it will come back to itself. Such great accomplishment. Now let's look at what happens with the spinner. And here's the time I can't delay further to introduce the some representation of gamma matrices. Because I can't do any calculation if I don't know, because I'm specifically looking for S12. to be able to compare with this one. So let's see. One representation is given called the well chiral base. The name of the chiral, we will have emphasized on that, a lot of them later. It's given by, so these are all 2x2 things. So the idea is we first try dimension 2x2 matrices, and we find three. The Pauli matrices are nicely anti-commute with each other. And square to minus one, it's awesome. If I just can find a fourth matrix, well, I'm all done. But you can't find any matrix anti-commute with all of them. So, bummer. We have to move on. And if you read the appendix, which tells you why that certain gamma matrices exist in certain dimension, it turns out that if you want four gamma matrices, you have to be in four-dimension representation. You probably can go higher, but this is the lowest that you can go. Okay, so this is just one representation. And of course, there is a theorem says all the representation of the gamma matrices are equivalent. And there is actually, you can go for one of a reference to tell you specifically how to construct the matrix to bring them into each other with a similar transformation. So if you write on one, all the rest are equivalent to this one. But we'll stick with this one. And the reason for why this one is nice in a lot of ways, we'll see in the next lecture. Okay, but let's stick with this and calculate what's S12. So it's a quarter of the commutator of gamma 1 or gamma 2, but they are anti-commuting, so that's just mean I calculated one half the multiplication. So one half multiplied by that. If you are familiar with multiplying with this Pauli matrix together, you might remember that it gave you I sigma 3. Okay, so that's the result. And we know epsilon 1,2 is theta. So it must be E to the 1/2 is coming from here, minus I 1/2 theta minus I sigma 3. So that's a generic rotation around the z-axis for a spinner. We calculate the generator, we use the same parameter, just like the Lorentz transformation, and we get that. And you're like, what is it? Well, I can't tell you what is it for all theta, but for theta equals 2 pi, what do you think it equals to? Well, we'll take a minute to calculate. This is the most important result of today's lecture, is that we figure out when we change the coordinate such that we're in a different frame, such that it is rotated around the z-axis by 2 pi, how does psi transform? Yeah? Anybody has a result for me? It's minus one. It's minus one, literally minus one in all entries. It's the minus identity. Isn't it crazy? This thing, after turning 2 pi, doesn't return to itself. It returns to negative itself. And remember, like David told you about this heuristic argument about how to determine the spin of the gravity. Something like if you rotate 2 pi, it would be spin 1. If you return half of 2 pi, then it would be spin 2. And now apparently we need a 2 of 2 pi to return itself. So this is, okay, you might be frowning, but this is the heuristic argument to show that, okay, psi is a spin half. And some of you guys are nodding. Okay, but see, this, you know, by my opinion, is a slightly sloppy argument. Because by this argument, this thing has a spin 3. See? It'll come back to itself 3 times in one round. Well, this is certainly not a spin 3 particle. So we'll have to wait. We'll have to wait when we quantize Dirac Lagrangian, when we find our one particle state, and then we'll act the spin operator on that one particle state and read off, ha, the spin is 1/2. But you know, this is a pretty good way. We show that it rotated 2 pi, that it come back to negative itself. Okay. So, well, now I'm just going to do some generalization. Well, okay. Yeah, I guess it doesn't answer Matthias's question yet, because this thing is indeed unitary. So this is indeed unitary and its rotations. Oh, actually, no, I have a question before we move on. But I did something like sneaky. Well, it's not I'm being sneaky, but I have no choice. I choose a certain base to calculate that it rotate come to minus 1. But what if I choose a different base? Would it be different? It better not to, right? Well, remember, somebody proved all the representation are related by similar transformation. So if you have some similar transformation, let's just A minus 1 times A, since it's minus identity in the middle, it will still give you minus identity. So yes, no matter which representation you are calculating, this thing will rotate back to minus itself after 2 pi rotation. Okay, so the last thing I want to do is actually write down so I'm just doing some generalization by bringing an I in and there is some theta. Sorry, this doesn't work. So this is the exponent and the matrix is 2 to the I theta dot sigma, 2 to the I theta dot sigma. Basically, I say I can do the same calculation in the other two directions too. And I can just generalize my results to all rotations because they are all diagonal matrices. You can multiply them easily just by adding the exponent up. And as interestingly, the rotations are all unitary. And of course, you wonder about the boost, but then we'll come back to it tomorrow. To summarize, psi is a spinner that would spin 1/2.
And I think that's a good point to stop.